the second one. Actually, it's going to be the first one you teach, but it's the second one chronologically, right? What imperialism is she talking about? She's talking about European imperialism, I assume, right? I assume you're talking about the scramble for Africa. I assume you're talking about the acquisition of dominance of India by the British. That's what I'm assuming what you're thinking about. You have to remember the 19th century, the late 19th century, is the all-time great land grab. European powers are carving out colonies and carving up spheres of influence throughout the world and formalizing their empires. The problem is, if Germany makes the Philippines their colony, we can't trade there. We will not have access there. They will shut us out. And so to some degree, our expansion is built upon the idea that if we do not acquire these spheres of interest and we do not acquire these colonies, other empires will. Other nations, other powers will do that before we get the chance. And so strategy is important. You ought to see these things as also vital in terms of the naval building programs of the United States in the 1890s, the very first decade of the 20th century. Building a navy with capital battleships capable of basically challenging anyone else upon the high seas. In fact, the articulation of that, the theoretical articulation of that, was an American scholar, American naval officer and historian, Alfred Thayer Mahon. How many of you have heard of Alfred Thayer Mahon? A few of you. Exactly. Still in print. The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, still in print. Tremendously influential book in the late 19th century, in which Mahon essentially argued that great empires, great nations were always naval powers. Right? In fact, Mahon would take that in his writings all the way back to the ancient world. Right? He would argue that Rome, even though Rome's primarily known for its army, Rome was also a great naval power, which is true. And so, in order to be a great power, a great nation in the world, you have to have a navy, a large navy with capital battleships. The reason Napoleon fails, according to Mahon, is Trafalgar, right? He has not the naval capacity to basically land an army in England and thus conquer England. He's stuck to the continent itself. The reason the Confederacy fails, according to Mahon, is the lack of a navy, the lack of naval power. And so he's articulating that by using history. And, of course, in the process, what Mahon is doing is he's arguing the United States should build a great navy. And, by the way, other people in the world are reading that book, too. I mean, the British love that book. Mahon shows up in London. He's wined and dined by the Admiralty. He's treated like the greatest thing since sliced bread. He's telling them, essentially, you people have been doing it right all along, right? You're the one. You fellows know exactly what you're doing. You are the example of what we should do. In Germany, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, reads The Influence of Sea Power Upon Us, reads it in English. The Kaiser can read and speak English perfectly. All of his letters to the Tsar of Russia, his cousin Nicholas, who he refers to as Nicky, and Nicky calls him Willie, right? All those letters, all those telegrams are in English. All of his diplomatic marginalia is in English. He admires England. He is the grandson of Queen Victoria, right? And so he reads it in the original English and is enthralled with it, has it translated into German, becomes required reading for German naval officers, captain, and above. And so Mahan's influencing us, but he's also influencing others. And so we're building a great navy, and if you're going to have a navy in the 1890s, obviously you're going to need coaling stations because we're talking about steam power, right? We're not talking about wooden ships with sail. We're talking about steam power, so you need coaling stations. Why do we need Hawaii? Think about where it's at, right? Yes, Sanford B. Dole and the United Fruit Company have other interests, their economic interests there, but it's also a vital coaling station, right? On the way to Asia and on the way to that market. Why do you want the Philippines? John Hay had talked about the open door, right? The idea that the United States, in fact, all the industrial powers, should have equal access to the markets in China. Well, the Philippines as our foot in the open door, right? And the Navy, and a building of a Navy is a part of that. I mean, that you can't have that aspect. You can't have that policy without a great Navy. The drive toward an Isthmian Canal, which by the British Admiralty's own estimate, I'm talking about how the British see this, the British Admiralty's own estimate will double the strength of the American Navy if we have an Isthmian Canal. In fact, building a great Navy, building the Navy we built in the 1880s and 1890s, and especially when Theodore Roosevelt becomes president, and acquiring territory and building a canal are all same part of the same policy. Right? One doesn't make sense without the other. When we do go to war with Spain in 1898, the USS Oregon was stationed in San Francisco. By the time the Oregon makes it all the way around the coast of South America into the Caribbean, the war's over. Right? So they don't actually get to participate in the war because of that distance, to cut that distance. If we're going to have interest in the Caribbean and in the Pacific, having a canal was absolutely vital. So it shouldn't be surprising that what we begin to see, once the United States has the might, has the capability, that happens, right? That eventually does happen. And so strategic concerns are also, I think, important in that sense. So all these things together kind of help explain where we're going in the 1890s. But once we get there, it's kind of interesting to look at the kinds of policies that the United States develops as a world leader. And as far as the European nations were concerned, in many ways, Theodore Roosevelt was the first American president to be kind of viewed as a world leader. And he certainly cultivated that. He consciously cultivated that. And so when we look at his policy, we're certainly looking at the policy of someone who's very much aware that they are essentially a world leader in every sense. And Roosevelt, I think, occupies a very unique place in the history of American foreign relations. And I'll give you a quote here, actually from Henry Kissinger. Jeremy Seary has written a book on Kissinger, but Kissinger wrote a book some years ago, about 20 years ago, I'd say, called Diplomacy. Didn't you read Diplomacy by Kissinger? It says something that you can write a book and call it Diplomacy, right? But Kissinger, in his book Diplomacy, wrote about Theodore Roosevelt, and I quote, "Roosevelt commands a unique historical position in America's approach to international relations. No other president defined America's world role so completely in terms of national interest or identified the national interest so comprehensively with the balance of power," unquote. Jeremy Seary continued, rightfully so, generally speaking, the United States has rejected what he referred to earlier, if you caught this, he referred to as classical diplomacy, the world of classical diplomacy. The United States rejected the type of systems and negotiations and even the types of career diplomats in the same sense that European powers had, right? Court diplomacy, as he referred to it, coming out of the 18th century, in which you have noblemen come to another court, represent their nation, negotiate, go to the ball and dance with the queen, and have dinner, at Versailles, and all those kinds of things. The United States generally was very, very reluctant to embrace that. And I was telling Bill during lunch, all you have to do is think about essentially how Americans view Talleyrand, like during the XYZ affair. You're familiar with that, right? In the XYZ affair during the Quasi-War, Talleyrand would not even begin negotiations unless he was given a personal gift. He wanted to guarantee a loan to the Directory in France. Like $12 million, and this a massive personal gift to himself of $250,000 or something of that nature. And, of course, the American envoys were outraged, right? Say it again. Yeah, right? Not millions for tribute, not a sixpence. I mean, millions for defense, not a sixpence for tribute, right? I think Pinckney says that. And so they reject what Talleyrand was doing. Talleyrand's right in the vein in terms of classical diplomacy. I mean, he is a brilliant diplomat in every way, shape, and form. Read, if you're interested in him, read Duff Cooper's bio of him. Duff Cooper was a British historian and politician, member of the House of Commons, a good friend of Winston Churchill's, wrote a great book on Talleyrand, right? right? I mean, Talleyrand's a colorful character, no doubt about that, but the idea that the Americans viewed him with distaste and disdain, when actually he was doing what European diplomats had been doing, you know, for so long. So the United States very reluctant to embrace even the structures of classic European-style diplomacy. Theodore Roosevelt's somewhat of an exception to that. In a sense, the Theodore Roosevelt, when we look at his policy, we look at TR's diplomacy and his foreign affairs, TR very much conducts things almost in a classical fashion. Even in terms of the mechanics of negotiation. He's tough. He's tough for historians. Historians have a difficult time getting at Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy. Probably the best single volume work I can think of on the topic would be Frederick Marx, that's Marks, the third. It's called Velvet on Iron. But the reason why Roosevelt's difficult to get to is because he's secretive. And he conducts so much diplomacy face to face. He doesn't leave a paper trail. Now, to go back here, you got TR and you have Woodrow Wilson. Both are historians, right? Woodrow Wilson was actually a trained academic historian. TR was not. TR probably has a more significant legacy as a writer in many ways than Wilson. TR had written a significant naval history of the War of 1812 in his 20s when he came out of Harvard College in the 1880s. It's still in print. It's still used. Walter Borneman's rather popular book on the War of 1812 that came out a couple of years ago uses it quite a bit if you look at the notes that Borneman has in his book. So TR knows about how to write history. He wrote Winning of the West in 4 volumes, which was a bestseller. He wrote a biography of Cromwell while he was president, Oliver Cromwell, which he dictated. I've always said fascinating. Guys like Roosevelt and Winston Churchill can write books and yet do all these other things at the same time, right? I have trouble teaching 4 classes. But Sir Winston Churchill can do all those things and write, you know, a 7-volume biography of Marlborough or something like that while he's doing it all. T.R. dictated this book on Cromwell. By the way, the book tells us a lot more about him than it does about Cromwell. It's Theodore Roosevelt as Oliver Cromwell in many ways. But he understands how history is written. He understands about source material. And he consciously is not leaving source material for you and I. You do not find the foreign policy of Theodore Roosevelt in blue books. You do not find it in document collections printed and published by the State Department. I mean, if you were interested in the foreign relations of the United States with Germany in 1892, I would tell you to go to the main library. I would tell you to go into, I think it used to be in the basement, go to the papers relating to the foreign relations of the United States, look for the volume for 1892, and go to the section on Germany, and read all those documents between our minister in Germany and the State Department. You're wasting your time between 1901 and 1909 if you're looking for Theodore Roosevelt and the papers relating to the foreign relations of the United States. It's not there. His foreign affairs is not, his diplomacy is not there. If you're going to find out what he's doing, you have to look at private documents. You have to look at a letter he writes to Henry Cabot Lodge, or a letter he writes to Cecil Spring Rice, a private letter that he's not expecting to be published. He consciously doesn't want to leave a paper trail. He's reluctant to negotiate treaties, because he knows that treaties have to be ratified by the Senate. He wants to conduct as much foreign policy face-to-face as possible. And in that film, I mean, in that clip, when Brian Keith is playing Theodore Roosevelt, what kind of things is Theodore Roosevelt doing? Boxing, right? He's shooting arrows. He did those kinds of things, right? And that's how he conducted diplomacy. If you were part of the diplomatic corps of another nation, if you were sent to represent another nation, what you had to do is you had to do those things with him. Right, he goes for a walk, right, or a run, what have you, and he comes to the Potomac, he swims across it, he expects you to do the same thing, right? Eventually, nations start to figure out we have to send a young man to visit Theodore Roosevelt because he'll kill an older man, right? Because you can't keep up with him. France was especially fortunate because of Jules Josserand, who liked to play tennis. And so he played tennis with T.R. T.R. wants to talk face-to-face, but he doesn't want a record. Right? It's secretive. It's secretive diplomacy. That's like Metternich. That's like Bismarck. I mean, Bismarck wouldn't want you to play tennis with him or box with him. He'd want you to drink beer and eat sausage, but he wanted to be face-to-face. He doesn't want a paper trail left behind. Right? So T.R. is hard to put his finger on, or to put your finger on when you're looking for what he's doing in terms of foreign affairs. You have to find it in private correspondence. You have to find it in what other people say about the conversations they have with the president. You do not find it in official documents. Right? That makes him a little tricky in terms of dealing with his foreign affairs. Very conscious, again, of the idea that he is a world leader. And in fact, Brian Keefe's portrayal, certainly part of that is taken from this photograph of Theodore Roosevelt. I think it says a lot about what Theodore Roosevelt thinks about the United States and their place in the world. I mean, he's got his hand on the globe. By the way, he doesn't have his hand anywhere near Africa. That's, of course, North America, right? That's the hemisphere that's important now as far as he's concerned. Just the stance, right? The aggression, the confidence, the exuberance, all that you can certainly see in that photograph. And T.R. was photographed so much, I don't think he did anything without having a photographer nearby, right? He would not be photographed playing tennis. I mentioned Jules Sorin in tennis because he didn't think it fit his image, right? It wasn't sweaty enough. It wasn't manly enough. It was a little too, elite. I'm sorry, Brian, you must be a tennis player. but that didn't fit his image, right? So he was very conscious of being photographed. He wanted to be photographed riding a horse. He was the first president to be photographed in action, right? Jumping a rail, things like that. So usually when he is photographed in this stage, it is saying something. And that photograph certainly does say something. Right? In terms of some of the actual nuts and bolts of the policy, I think that one of the most important things that takes place during his presidency, the Philippine insurrection, which Professor Suri talked about, is certainly a part of his presidency. But I think the Entente Cordiale, which is like an informal alliance with Britain. Britain was often, up to this point, seen as an enemy, right, of the United States very often. But what we see developing by 1905 is a clearing away of all diplomatic obstacles between the United States and Great Britain. And in fact, by 1905, we essentially have an informal alliance with Great Britain. Britain is in an interesting position. They've fallen behind in terms of steel production. If you looked at, I do have a table, I won't use it. If you look at the capital battleship production of the various powers at this time, you will notice that Britain has more capital battleships than any other nation. In absolute numbers, they're way ahead. But they have a serious strategic dilemma by the 1890s, in a sense that the British Empire is obligated everywhere in the world. They have an iron in every fire, right? And so even though they have more battleships than the United States, by 1898, they are relatively weak when it comes to the Caribbean, right? In relative terms, they're inferior. Although they have more battleships than Japan, by 1900 or so, they're inferior in Asia to Japan. And then, of course, you have the overwhelming dilemma for the British, the fact that Germany is building battleships, right? The German naval building program, which is, of course, the Kaiser, advised by Admiral von Tirpitz, is undertaking, creates a tremendous strategic dilemma for the British. Because the bulk of the German fleet will be in the North Seas. That's so close to the home island. And so from the British point of view, they have to find a way to bring force from other parts of the world back to the home island. They have to worry about Germany. And what they basically do is they acquiesce to powers that they call the peripheral powers. Not because they're peripheral or unimportant, but because of where they're located in terms of the globe. And that's the United States and Japan. Great Britain had had been isolated. It had been engaged in what they called splendid isolation. After the Napoleonic Wars, Britain no longer wants to engage in any kind of direct alliance with any nation, if at all possible. And so they had avoided that after the Napoleonic period. And they end that splendid isolation actually in this period that we're thinking about. With Japan, it will come as a formal alliance. Great Britain will have a defensive military alliance with Japan. The fact that it's defensive is important. Because if it was a full military alliance, that would have created tremendous problems for them. It's a defensive military... You know what I'm saying when I... You know what I mean when I say defensive military alliance? Let me shake your head. A defensive military alliance between Japan and between Britain and Japan means that if another nation attacks Japan, Britain is obligated. If Russia attacks Japan, Britain is obligated to come in on Japan's side. But if Japan starts it, if Japan's the aggressor, then Britain, of course, doesn't have to. It doesn't have to become involved. So it's a defensive military alliance. That's how they basically develop a situation and develop develop a situation in which they can depend upon Japan or going to depend upon Japan in Asia in terms of their own interests, and they can bring force out of Asia. With the United States has a long tradition themselves of no entangling alliances, which of course goes back to Washington's farewell address. It's not going to be a formal alliance. It's going to be essentially like a gentleman's agreement, an informal alliance, right? By 1905, that's in place. So Theodore Roosevelt plays a major role in terms of putting that in place. You have to remember, as recent as 1895, there had been a war scare between Britain and the United States, right? Actually, over the boundary between Venezuela and British Guiana. The Orinoco River in particular. And no one cared about where that boundary was until gold was discovered there. And then all of a sudden it becomes really, really important, right? And Grover Cleveland, who is not exactly an interventionist and expansionist figure, Stern mentioned that he had stated that we shouldn't get involved in Cuba, right, on several occasions. Grover Cleveland, however, in this instance, takes a tough stand against Britain, right? Grover Cleveland being the president, Lord Salisbury was the prime minister, and also he served as his own Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. That's somewhat unusual. He was Queen Victoria's favorite minister. In fact, she would allow him to sit in her presence. That's how much she admired Lord Salisbury. Richard Olney, who was the Secretary of State for Cleveland, invoked the Monroe Doctrine. And the Monroe Doctrine says what? Look out for the interests of the free people in our hemisphere. No new colonies. The same thing. You're going to say the same thing she said? So we don't want any more European intervention or any more not European intervention, any more European taking, no more European possessions, I guess you might say. So here you have a European power wanting to expand at the expense of Venezuela, which would mean acquiring more territory at the expense of an American state. And so we invoke the Monroe Doctrine. Salisbury takes 4 months to respond to that note. 4 months. Essentially describes the Monroe Doctrine as paper. It's just a piece of paper. In other words, he's not impressed. He's not impressed. And that essentially is where it stands until Germany makes overtures toward the United States. And when Germany starts to make overtures toward the United States, Britain changes their tune. And Britain gives us, they succumb to our interpretation of the boundary. And this is the first of a series of situations in which Britain essentially appeases us. They acquiesce to our interests. Now, more and more, it's becoming evident that they really have no choice. This is the first instance in which they are going to appease us and acquiesce. They're going to allow the United States to essentially have what they're demanding. They're going to basically give in and essentially hope that that establishes good relations with the United States. Which it does. Which it does. And we see this especially increase after 1898, because it's clear the United States, again, is becoming a major naval power. That the United States is beginning to have the might to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, really, it comes right down to it. The Monroe Doctrine was essentially paper. We couldn't enforce it. Actually, in many ways, Britain enforced it. In many ways, Britain enforced it. That's why I went through Canning, right? Britain enforced it because they began to understand back in the 1830s, 1820s and 1830s, they were beginning to understand that all these new republics and democracies made good trading partners. And the British joint stock companies were making money trading with these people. And so allowing, you know, the Bourbons to reestablish their control, you know, through the Holy Alliance made no sense. And so it wasn't in their interest. And so Britain, in essence, enforces that for us. But by the 1890s, we have the muscle to do it ourselves. And not only will we do that, Theodore Roosevelt, in fact, will expand the Monroe Doctrine. Expand it considerably. He's going to put a little twist on the Monroe Doctrine, a corollary, that we'll get to here in a little bit. But what we see here at this particular point is Britain is acquiescing, right? And we're going to see other situations in which you kind of see the same kind of thing. Now, you have to remember, I'll just go back to your slide, this picture. I don't know how well you can see that picture. That is Consuelo Vanderbilt, the famous Vanderbilt family, the railroad tycoons. She is there with her husband, the 7th Duke of Marlborough. And so this kind of, I think, is emblematic of something that we see happening quite a bit in this particular period. In fact, we can identify 130 instances in which the daughters of prominent American industrialists marry into the British nobility. And so you literally have connections, marital family connections, between the elites in the United States and the nobility in Britain. All right? So that had to influence policy to some degree. There are a lot of things that would draw us toward Britain rather than, let's say, Germany. Right? Language, certainly a political system that's more similar than what Germany has. I mean, Germany does have an elected parliament, the Reichstag, but in Germany, power is in the hands of the emperor's administration, right? It's autocracy with the trappings of liberalism, really more than anything else. But what we see is there's so many things culturally that also would kind of draw us toward Britain rather than Germany, rather than toward some of the other powers. But Britain's going to see it in their interest to, of course, give favorable policy. This, of course, is encouraged by certain key figures, and especially with one relationship. John Hay, who some of you probably heard of, who was Lincoln's personal secretary as a young man, was ambassador to Britain, and then was Secretary of State for McKinley and then Secretary of State for Roosevelt. Certainly was in favor of an informal agreement and a formal relationship with Britain. And he certainly tries to promote that in every way. He's somewhat of an Anglophile. In fact, Britain is for him the example of what we want to be. Right? He spends so much time in England that he admires them so much. He also had a fairly close personal friendship with the ambassador to the United States, the British ambassador, Lord Julian Pauncefoot. And so that relationship is one of many. The one between Theodore Roosevelt and Cecil Spring Rice is another example. Is one of many relationships among key figures that helps to produce this kind of a situation. In fact, we often know them for their work together on the Hay-Pauncefoot Treaty. Right? I mean, Theodore Roosevelt has two very, very early policy successes involving relations with Britain, and one of them is the Hay-Pauncefoot Treaty. Have you heard of the Hay-Pauncefoot Treaty? The Hay-Pauncefoot Treaty of 1901 essentially abrogated an earlier agreement called the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty. Back in 1850, the United States and Great Britain had negotiated the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty. And the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty held that any future canal in Latin America would be jointly owned and jointly controlled by Great Britain and the United States. And back in 1850, that's a good deal for the United States, right? Back in 1850, that's a phenomenal deal. By 1900, that's not true. By 1901, that's not true as far as many Americans are concerned. They want to not only own the canal, they want to control the canal, they want to be able to fortify the canal. They want a free hand in terms of the development of this canal. And so Hay and Ponsonbut, in the wake of the Spanish-American War, during the latter days of McKinley's administration, Hay and Ponsonbut essentially are negotiating a treaty that will get rid of the old Clayton-Bull War and allow the United States to own, to be the sole owner of any future canal. This is well before the Panamanian Revolution in 1903. This is well before we even start digging the first shovelful as far as the Panama Canal is concerned. But the idea is it's going to happen, right? Whether it happens in Panama, whether it happens in Nicaragua, there's going to be an Isthmian Canal. That's the way it's going to be. So the Hay-Ponsonbut Treaty is an attempt, essentially, to do away with the old treaty. Initially, when you look at the very first draft of it, the idea is that the United States will own the canal, but it would be open to all powers in war and in peace. And for expansionists in the United States Senate, that was unacceptable. And I have a few quotes here we can kind of use to kind of see how this progresses, and then we'll come back and talk about the Canadian-Alaskan boundary dispute. This is from Henry Cabot Lodge, right? He's writing to White, who is the American minister to Britain. Lodge, of course, senator from Massachusetts. And here's what he has to say. This is December 18th, 1900, and he says, "The American people mean to have the canal, and they mean to control it. Now, England does not care enough about it to go to war to prevent our building it, and it would be ruinous if she did make war on us. At the same time, Britain's engaged in, of course, the Boer War in South Africa, and they're greatly distracted, and we're very much aware of that, right?" And so he's saying, you know, they're either going to give us what we want, or there's going to be a rupture, right? And American policymakers are very conscious of the weakness that Britain is in relatively, and how Britain really needs friendship with the United States, especially because of the rising power of Germany. And so Lodge, who is one of these expansionists, in fact, a great book about some of these guys just came out a couple years ago, is The War Lovers by Evan Thomas. Have you read that? The War Lovers by Evan Thomas. It's in paperback now. Very well written about Theodore Roosevelt and Lodge and that crowd. And by the way, they also make the case. It's called The War Lovers because the idea is that these guys are militarists and that they believe that the United States needs to engage in military activity because war is something that will keep Americans from becoming too soft. I mean, if you read some of the quotes from Theodore Roosevelt at this time, and some of them are, I think, very disturbing. I mean, a man who says openly and publicly that that any triumph in peace is not as great as the supreme triumph of war. A man who talks about, how great it is to when the wolf rises in your heart, right? When you're ready to smell blood, these fellows believe that war, and it's also why Theodore Roosevelt liked sport and hunting. He believed those kinds of things. The problem with America is that we're engaged in industrialization and commerce. We can become flabby. We can become soft. We can become effeminate from his point of view. And things like sport and hunting and war, he thought would invigorate us, which is a very romantic and simplistic and, as it turns out when you look at the First World War, a very wrong-headed approach to really what war was becoming. I mean, the Spanish-American War was an exceptional conflict in which one side is incredibly prepared and the other side is very poorly prepared, much like the Wars of German Unification, in which one side wins and wins quickly and decisively. Industrial warfare was not going to be that way, though. I mean, the Civil War shows us that, right? The Civil War showed that the industrial warfare was going to be long, it was going to be difficult, it was going to be bloody. And the kind of horror, the kind of terror that the First World War brought on was something that Theodore Roosevelt never envisioned. And when he wanted to go, I mean, when the First World War comes, he wants to raise a division and go into battle, lead troops into battle. He can't see out of one eye at that particular point. He has no business, involved in any kind of military command whatsoever at that particular juncture. But he has this romantic notion of conflict. And so they talk so aggressively because of what they think about war. And so Evan Thomas's point is that they're war lovers. And so when you look at Lodge's statement, I mean, push comes shove, we're going to war with Britain to make sure that we get what we want in this sense. We're going to own the canal, we're going to control the canal, we're going to fortify the canal, and they better just get used to it because that's the way it's going to be, right? And so he says this in December 18th, 1900. Theodore Roosevelt says this March 27th, 1901, while he's vice president, right? Because he's McKinley's vice president. He's elected in 1900. McKinley will be assassinated that fall. T.R. will become president, right? But he says this as vice president, which also tells us that McKinley kind of has him on the outside looking in terms of policy making. He says, and I quote, "We should tell Britain that we wanted to be friendly and would like a treaty that would keep their self-respect as well as ours. If that is impossible, I would then abrogate the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty anyhow." I'll just go ahead and abrogate it unilaterally, and they can just they can live with it, right? They can just swallow that and chew on that for a while. That's the way they can handle it. And so he says, "I just abrogate the treaty. They don't give in to us, I'm going to abrogate it." The thing is, he becomes president in a few short months, right? That's going to mean an instantaneous change in politics. And if you read, for example, the British, read the papers of the British, the letters the British are writing, things are going back between Lord Ponsonby and Lord Lansdowne, who's now taken over for Salisbury as Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Ponsonby's saying to Lansdowne, "This Roosevelt guy, he's just going to take it. He is just simply going to do what he wants. We're either going to have to go to war or we're going to have to find some way to save face." They know that. They know that. They're aware of the position that Britain is in. Here is Hay on, you can't really see, but it's June 18th, 1901. Here is Hay, and he is writing to White. And Hay wants to avoid a rupture, right? Because of the close relationship he has with Ponsonby. He admires the British. And Hay also is from the previous generation. Hayes from the Civil War generation. Most of those expansionists were not. I mean, McKinley, very reluctant to go to war in 1898. And he wanted to make sure that he had the American people behind him. Roosevelt, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, said privately that McKinley, and I quote, "has the backbone of a chocolate eclair," unquote. Right? He has the backbone of a chocolate eclair. He has no guts. But McKinley had seen war. And McKinley, if you look at McKinley's Civil War diaries, he talks about seeing the bodies stacked up like firewood, right? McKinley had seen the horrors of war. Roosevelt hadn't, until he actually goes into Cuba in 1898. He hadn't seen combat. But McKinley had. Hay knew something about the Civil War, obviously, in the Lincoln administration. So Hay wanted to avoid this, but he's trying to be very straightforward. He's telling White, they, meaning the British, ought to know, and I'm very glad you told him, Balfour, who's the new Prime Minister at this particular point, Arthur Balfour, that if we cannot agree on a treaty before December, nothing can prevent a violent legislative abrogation of the CB Convention, the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty, right? Nothing. They have to basically come up with a better position here, as far as we're concerned, or this is going to be the Senate's just going to go ahead and abrogate the old treaty, and we're going to take the canal zone at some point. And we're going to build it. We're going to control it, fortify it, and everything. What essentially happens is Britain gives us everything we want. They had to. The only other option was a rupture, right? And rather than have that take place, Britain gives us the exact treaty we want. We will not only control it, we will not only own it, we will control it, we will fortify it, the whole bit. And having the Hay-Ponsonby Treaty in 1901 in its final form is what eventually paves the way for the Panama Canal. And the reason that Britain does it is they have to have good relations with the United States, and they're concerned about Germany. The other concession that they give Theodore Roosevelt, or I say give Theodore Roosevelt, the idea that Theodore Roosevelt is really taking it, if they don't give it, he'll take it, is a favorable boundary between Canada and Alaska. If you have any trouble with insomnia, read the Treaty of 1868 between the United States and Russia, where they're purchasing Alaska, and read that boundary. I mean, the only other thing that's better is my apologies to all the Marxists in the audience and across the world. But the only other thing I think is even close is Karl Marx, Capital, Volume 1. That thing, keep it by your bedside whenever you're a little bit inclined not to sleep, you get a little insomnia. Just start reading a few pages, and you'll be out before you know it. That Treaty of 1868 and that boundary is totally unintelligible, right? I mean, it's the wording; it's horrible. And you know, the only area that really matters at this particular point is the Lynn Canal. And that's mainly because the Lynn Canal is the only area in which you can inject men, material, etc., into the Yukon Territory by sea. And no one really cared until the 1890s. I mean, the six people who live there do not care until the 1890s. But when gold's discovered there, all of a sudden, it really matters, right? It really matters. There's a difference of opinion in terms of the boundary. I don't know if this is how well this will work, but the blue line is what the United States claims. The yellow line is what we're going to get. The red line, I don't know if you can see it very well, is right there, is what the British claimed. Right? The line that we get is very favorable. Right? They're going to give us a really, really good boundary between the Yukon and the Lynn Canal as far as the United States was concerned. The treaty that called for arbitration basically called for each side to send three, and the wording says eminent jurists, quote unquote. Theodore Roosevelt, well, first the British send three eminent jurists. They give the Canadians one seat. I mean, Canada has a very limited autonomy at this particular point, so the Canadians have one position on the tribunal, the other two are British. Roosevelt sends George Norris, I believe, who's a congressman from North Dakota. He sends Elihu Root, who's will eventually be a Secretary of War, a good friend, who is an eminent jurist, and he sends Henry Cabot Lodge. He sends people that he knows will see it a certain way. Right? In fact, I don't have a slide with this on there, but he writes a wonderful letter to Lodge, and he's talking to Lodge about the boundary. And I'm going to paraphrase him, obviously. He says, you know, dear Cabot, I'm so glad that you're representing us on the tribunal. You will be fair and you will be impartial. You will look at all the evidence and arrive at a fair conclusion. Now, here are all the reasons why the Jacks, because of the British, do not have a leg to stand on. Blah, 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 the treaty says, blah, 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 at the end. We already have our troops there. All right? So basically, he's saying, you're going to be fair and you're going to be impartial, you're going to listen to all the evidence, but here's why you're going to arrive at the conclusion that I'm telling you to arrive at, right? Here's why you're going to come up with this particular boundary, right? And so you can kind of see that also in some of these quotes. This is Sir Wilfrid Laurier, who was the Canadian Prime Minister, and he says, it is suggested that the American jurists will never agree to any decision which would cause loss of the disputed territory to the United States. That may be, but this is no argument against the treaty itself. It is rather an argument against the honesty of American jurists, right? And I can only hope that it is a slanderous insinuation. Turned out not to be slanderous, right? When it come right down to it, it was going to be... when the boundary was finally decided, the vote was going to be obviously 5-1. Right? The Canadians would be sold out by the British in order to court good American relations. Roosevelt had this to say about it. He said, if the Jacks realize that while it may be unpleasant to us, it will be far more unpleasant to them if they force the alternative upon us, if we simply announce that the country is ours and will remain so, and that so far as it has not been reduced to possession, it will be reduced to possession, and that no further negotiations in the matter will be entertained. He comes across very much like a European-style realist, bearing out what Kissinger wrote about him so many years later. He basically is like, you know, an American Bismarck in that sense. You know, we're going to do what's in our interest. We have the power to do it. Hope you like it. If you don't, that's tough, right? So a very, very much almost a kind of an approach toward diplomacy that sees things in terms of the raison d'etat, right? Reason or right of state, and that's all that really matters. And so he gets a favorable boundary, obviously, in terms of Canada and Alaska. And if, of course, the British will not agree to it, he'll just simply take it, is the notion. However, the result is by 1905, there are no diplomatic blocks between the United States and Great Britain. The relationship that the United States has with Great Britain in the First and Second World Wars, the roots of that is really back here in 1895, 1905, in so many ways. In terms of Latin America, you can also see this realist approach in many ways with the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine, of course, said that we will not tolerate additional European colonies in the New World. Roosevelt has kind of a different twist on this. He enhances the Monroe Doctrine with this corollary. What he's basically saying, some of you heard of this, I'm sure, right? Say it again. Well, he does talk about that. And so all the political cartoons, you know, he always has the big stick, right? And so it's certainly something here, the big stick in the Caribbean. The big stick is the Navy, right? It's the military force. The Roosevelt corollary holds that not only do we not want any more colonies, we're not going to permit European powers to intervene in affairs in Latin American nations. And in fact, we will use police power to prevent that. So, for example, this is true of Santo Domingo. They default on loans to Imperial Germany. Germany's going to intervene. What the United States does is we intervene. We take over the customs houses. We start collecting money and start paying the Germans. So we intervene in order to keep the Europeans from intervening. The political cartoon kind of shows this, right? So here you have the European power, Germany, I guess, in this instance. The Latin American nations are, and all these political cartoons are often portrayed as children. That paternalism, right? And Uncle Sam or TR are, you know, the adults. And so here we are. That's the Monroe Doctrine, the canon. We're going to intervene. We'll collect the money. We'll make sure they get paid. But they're not getting involved, right? You're staying out. So essentially the United States is saying to the rest of the world, we have the might to do this now. Latin America is our sphere of influence. So you know, if you're already there, that's one thing, but you need to stay out. You're not going to get anything else here. And you're not going to intervene. We're not going to give you a chance to have an excuse for intervention. Which means in American policy a strange contradiction. Because in Latin America, it was the Monroe Doctrine. Everybody else stay out. But in Asia, it was the open door, right? Everybody should have equal access. And somehow or another, American policymakers even at this time were somewhat perplexed at why the Japanese didn't understand that, right? I mean, the Japanese were like, if you could, I mean, the Japanese concept of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere is patterned on the Monroe Doctrine. What they really want is a Monroe Doctrine sphere of their own in Asia. And so we're saying, closed door here, open door there. And so there's definitely an inconsistency there. It's not one that bothers Theodore Roosevelt, right? It's not one that he's concerned with. That's our sphere of influence, right? Latin America is where we're going to have our canal, right? And of course, he gains the canal zone actually by tacit approval of course, the Panamanian Revolution against Colombia. There was a French canal company that had a failed attempt in Panama to build a canal, and they were going to sell their interest to the United States for $40 million. And so the United States wanted to buy that and offered Colombia $10 million for a canal zone in Panama, which was a province of Colombia at the time. And Colombia, you know, acting in their own national interest, tried to secure more money. And Roosevelt was offended by this. In fact, he said, in this political cartoon, here he is. Again, you know, you see that Colombia is portrayed as smaller, Uncle Sam's back here with a shovel. You know, we're ready to dig. But, you know, Roosevelt would say of the Colombian warlords, he said, it's easier, and I quote, it's easier to nail currant jelly to the wall than to strike a deal with Colombia. I mean, you'd be better off trying to nail jelly to the wall. I mean, TR did have a way of turning phrases. Now, you're going to nail jelly to the wall. He said about the Badlands, the Dakota Badlands, that they look like Poe sounds. I mean, so he had a way of like turning phrases. There's no doubt about that. And so essentially, what we do here is we give tacit consent. TR gives tacit consent to Philippe Jean Benoit Varilla, who represents that canal company, and is working with these Panamanian revolutionaries. He goes and visits Roosevelt. And Roosevelt doesn't say, we're going to support you, but what's going on, there's kind of a gentleman's agreement, right? If you can establish a new government and sell us that canal zone for $10 million, we'll recognize your government. And so Benoit Varilla, who's very much interested in selling those interests, that old company, of course, is doing everything he can to help produce that revolution, which happens in 1903, November 1903. Colombia here, might of the American naval and military power. And that's certainly, that is a very anti-Theodore Roosevelt cartoon. Right? His militarism. I mean, look at, how many weapons. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt loved weapons. I know that, but I doubt that that's really the case. But they're kind of convey the idea of his militarism. We give tacit or unofficial recognition of the Panamanian government within 24 hours. The revolution. And of course, Benoit Varilla is appointed as the Panamanian minister to the United States and negotiates the treaty that, of course, secures the canal zone. There were people who reacted very negatively against this. The New York Times said it was, and I quote, a sordid conquest. Right? And it's high-handed. I mean, it's high-handed. It's realpolitik in every way, shape, and form. Right? It's realism, European-style realism. Roosevelt, for his part, is justified by saying, I wasn't going to let anyone hold me up from doing a great thing for Uncle Sam and for the world generally, right? I was going to make sure that we were able to secure this. And so later on in California, he'll say, that I let Congress debate the canal, right? And meanwhile, while they were debating, I built it, right? While they're talking about it, I built it. He acts almost like a monarchy, almost like a king would act in some ways. And that's often the criticism of him, that he's enhancing executive power. That's also the criticism of him domestically very often, right? I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of this, in a sense that Theodore Roosevelt is a progressive in so many ways in terms of domestic policy. I mean, here's a guy who wants to make sure you have a pure Food and Drug Act, a Meat Inspection Act. The companies just can't sell you anything. And here's a fellow who, who's interested, in various laws that will regulate trusts and try to make sure they act for the public good. He mainly is interested in that because he's fearful of revolution. Because he thought if you don't put the brakes on the trusts, that eventually you have what he described as a riotous, wicked, violent Day of Atonement. Revolution, right? He's very conservative in many ways in terms of his motivations for reform, but he is a reformer. But ironically, very often, those who are reformers are the ones who are the most interventionist in terms of foreign policy. In other words, if we reform at home and we make ourselves better, that gives us a right to make others better, is how they basically frame it, how they think about it. And so, reform at home can justify, expansion abroad, I think is one way that William Appleman Williams put it in his book, Empire is a Way of Life. But we certainly see that realism in Roosevelt with the Panamanian Revolution. I always like that one. Roosevelt is a real treasure trove when it comes to political cartoons. Political cartoonists loved him. If I was a political cartoonist, I would have voted for him because it would have been good for me. I mean, wasn't Art Buchwald said usually often when the president's election is taking place, there's one guy who you think is good for the country, but the other guy that's good for what you're doing and what know, your business. I don't know about that, but a lot of them, if you look at the Theodore Roosevelt Association website, they have a lot of them. And not just the positive ones, even the negative ones. So, he was tailor-made for political cartoons. Here he, always with the shovel, right? There's the shovel, right? Letting the Panama Republic get released. Here's the canal treaty, etc. There's Manuvarilla, in that sense. The man behind the egg. Maybe so. Considering, you know, also you think about that in terms of the people who actually build the canal, right? Is that what you're saying? Or you're okay. All right. Quite a few people die in the building of the canal. Yeah. Even though you do realize that more earth was moved to build the West Virginia Turnpike, right? Yeah. We're at 3 billion cubic tons of earth for the West Virginia Turnpike. Yeah. Oh, it wasn't nowhere near as dangerous, right? But. Huh? Oh, the reason I know that is I used this document for West Virginia history, and it's really the Turnpike Commission, and they're bragging about how much earth they moved. We use more dynamite than any road, you know, in North America, and all that kind of thing. I think it depends on how you define imperialism. All right? He would not say imperialism; he would say expansion. You're saying it looks like imperialism, smells like imperialism. It's sure a very similar. I mean, it is imperialism, right? It is imperialism. But of course, the idea is, and I think you can kind of, this is something we could talk about. I know we're running kind of short on time, but in essence, the United States justifies its expansion and its activities overseas very often with a mission. You know, that's not really all that unique. I mean, the British also talked about how they were giving superior institutions and, jurisprudence, etc. The idea, though, is that I think Surrey kind of pointed out the notion that those places were always going to be British. British didn't want to give up India. The notion is that we often kind of viewed even areas that we acquired at some point later. Would have some form of self-government, even if overseen by us. I mean, Cuba is a great example. We do not take Cuba in the Spanish-American War, which is a Teller Amendment, right? Teller Amendment prevents us from doing it, but we actually establish a protectorate over Cuba. And so we're going to intervene again and again and again when they have elections we don't like. Right? If someone comes to power that is pursuing a policy that's contrary to our interests, we get involved. Right? We are controlling them in a way. Mm-hmm. Directly into the Constitution. Well, I think we certainly loosened up the Good Neighbor Policy during FDR. And then, of course, we really kind of reaped the benefits, or I guess we might say the ill fruits of that, with, of course, the Cuban Revolution in the late 1950s. We had supported Batista, you know, before Castro. So before Castro takes over. So, I mean, we really, our attempts to control Cuba finally turns against us at that particular point. It's a good point, right? Yeah. Informal empire. Sometimes called informal empire, right? Or neo-imperialism, as sometimes it's described. More political cartoons. I like that one. TR would love that one. He certainly, he would write in his autobiography that the canal was his greatest accomplishment. He even goes. He goes while he's in office and visits the canal zone. First time a president leaves the country while in office. In fact, the second time will be when Woodrow Wilson goes to Europe, right, to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles. But he actually goes. He talks to the workers. He gets up there, runs the machinery a little bit, makes sure that there's plenty of photographs taken. Right? In some ways, TR is like the first modern president. Because he's very much aware of media, at least the media of his time. He wouldn't make it today. Right? He wouldn't have made it in the 30s. He wouldn't have been suited for the politics of the 1930s, mainly because he did not have a good speaking voice. He was not an impressive orator. Theodore, if you listen to the recordings of his voice, there are some. He had a high, squeaky voice. It doesn't match his image. It doesn't match his look. But I mean, he had a high, squeaky voice with a patrician intonation. Someone said that listening to T.R. to Roosevelt give a speech was like listening to someone chew nails. Right? Ironically, Wilson had a low, booming voice. Right? Wilson had a great speaking voice and could really, and really had, you know, the oratorical skill T.R. did not have. T.R. would have never done well on radio. Right? Not like FDR. I mean, FDR was made for radio. But T.R. would not have done well in that format at all. In terms of Asia, Roosevelt was very much concerned about Japan, especially after Japan went to war with Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, even though you realize that Roosevelt set up a room in the White House in which he and his military advisors actually kind of followed the war. They had maps and everything and pins on the maps, and they were every bit of information they could find out about the Russo-Japanese War. They wanted to know. And they were kind of rooting for Japan in a way. Roosevelt had kind of a distaste for the Russians and for Russia generally. And part of it was a personal thing because he did not like the Russian minister of the United States. And that it's really kind of it's a personality clash, but it also has to do with his daughter. Roosevelt's daughter, his oldest daughter Alice, who by this point is in her late teens. She's a young, vivacious young woman who's very, very, you know, independent-minded. She wanted her father to purchase a car. T.R. didn't have an automobile until after his presidency. He purchased an automobile after his presidency, learned to drive it. He had a driver. He had a chauffeur. He did learn to drive the car. But he wouldn't buy one while he was in the White House. And she wanted one. But the Russian ambassador had a car. And so the Russian ambassador's daughter and the president's daughter would go down Pennsylvania Avenue at, you know, 30 miles an hour, which is about as fast as you'd probably go at that time, right? And this really, really irritated Roosevelt, right? I mean, Alice was just like a force all of her own, right? Someone asked Roosevelt once, why don't you control Alice? And he said, I can do one or two things. I can control Alice or I can run the country. I can't do both, right? And so she would carry a live snake in her purse. She flirted openly with men. She did things that, you know, that people usually do. Women didn't do at that particular time. And Roosevelt was just, you know, beside himself what to do with, right? And so part of it was that personal thing. But, you know, the Japanese do so well against the Russians. They destroy the Russian fleet at the Battle of Tsushima, which really takes Russia out as a naval power, which changed things a lot because Britain was very much concerned about Russia as a naval power. And once Russia is no longer a viable naval power, that made it easier for Britain to plan militarily with Russia. Russia had aligned with France in 1894. And so the Triple Entente really kind of comes together after the Battle of Tsushima in many ways. But Roosevelt was concerned that Japan was doing too well against Russia, that they were going to essentially take Russia out as a counterweight to Japan's power in Asia. And so, of course, he offered his good offices and helps negotiate the Treaty of Portsmouth, which ends the Russo-Japanese War and earns Theodore Roosevelt the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, the guy who said that no triumph in peace is as great as the supreme triumph of war is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Wow. Here he is, you know, Harper's Weekly. Always like this one because he's got the dove, and there's the prize. But here's the big stick, right? And he's wearing the Rough Riders uniform. Also in terms of dealing with Japan, we also see that realism in his secret diplomacy, because he negotiates secret agreements with Japan. These are not treaties. They're not formal treaties. They're secret agreements. The first is the Taft-Katsura Agreement in 1905, which essentially what Roosevelt was doing in the Taft-Katsura Agreement is he was recognizing Japan's sphere of influence in Korea for an exchange of Japan promising not to molest the Philippines. And the negotiation of that one was kind of interesting because Taft, of course, is his Secretary of War at this particular point, and he negotiates it for Roosevelt. And there's a whole smokescreen, a whole media smokescreen, so to speak. What happens is Alice, the daughter again, goes to Japan. And while she's hobnobbing with the imperial family and playing croquet and receiving presents and laughing and giggling and having a good time, Taft, who's there supposedly as her, I guess you might say, chaperone, is back here cutting the secret agreement with Katsura, right? So they use Alice, in essence, as somewhat of a smokescreen to disguise what they're really trying to do. A similar agreement is the Ryu Takahira agreement, which recognizes Japan's right to expand in Manchuria. And so, the origins of Pearl Harbor actually go back much further than 1941. But you can see a concern on the part of Roosevelt at this particular point. This is also why Roosevelt dispatches the Great White Fleet in 1907. Right? He sends the Great White Fleet on a world tour in 1907. Say it again? Right. And so he sends it in 1907. It's a display of muscle, right? And it's not just aimed at Japan, but I think primarily aimed at Japan. This, I think, turned out to be counterproductive. I mean, I think what this really did is encourage Japan to build more capital battleships. I mean, and this is very similar to the kinds of things that the Kaiser was doing in Germany. I mean, you realize the Kaiser in Germany really wanted an alliance with Britain, and felt that building a navy would accomplish that because they would intimidate Britain so much that Britain would realize that the only choice they had was to essentially form an alliance with Germany. And what it essentially did is it drove Britain into the arms of France and Russia. Right? So it's saber-rattling, and it doesn't turn out to work anywhere near as Roosevelt thought it would. Kind of a funny story about it. Congress only appropriated enough money for about halfway, right? But Roosevelt sent them anyway because he reasoned incorrectly that Congress would vote the rest of the money. Right? He's like, Congress is not going to do it. Not going to leave them. He tells Root, Congress is not going to leave the Navy without coal. It's not going to happen. Congress is going to vote that money. Right? It's going to happen. Right? And so he sends them and presents them with a fait accompli, and they actually have to do that. Between Roosevelt and Wilson, how much time do I have here? When am I supposed to go to 4:30? Oh, okay, good deal. Between Roosevelt and Wilson is, of course, the dollar diplomacy of Taft. Taft only has one term, and Taft primarily focuses on Latin America. But Taft has a serious problem in terms of foreign policy, and that actually is his former boss, Theodore Roosevelt, right? Because Roosevelt, on election night in 1904, had made the blunder in American political history, right? Because he had gathered reporters to himself after he'd been elected in his own right, and he told them that he would not accept a nomination for another term, that he would honor the two-term tradition of Washington. And in so doing, he had agreed to give up power in 1909, right? And which he would say later, he cut his right arm off if he could take that statement back, right? And so he handpicks Taft. Which he thinks Taft, is going to basically continue his progressive policy, which turns out not to be the case. And there's going to be a great falling out between Taft and Roosevelt. But Roosevelt leaves the country after the election, right? He goes to Africa, which he kills over, 200 animals and writes about it for McClure's magazine. And it's great when if you're interested in hunting, you read Roosevelt's descriptions of hunting and the way he talks about death of an animal. It's so graphic and brutal the way he describes these things, but apparently he was really popular for hunters to read that at this particular time. By the way, when he's in Africa, very often African tribes will throw dinners, or I guess you might say barbecues or whatever for him. Barbecues, is that a good word for this? I don't think. Whatever they throw for him, they will often greet him as the King of America. And he's often greeted as the King of America. Something which, by the way, he never says, I'm not the King of America. Right? He never denies that. After he's through with his safari, he goes up in Egypt and then into Europe. And so he's kind of like on this, major world tour, so to speak. Here he is, I think, in Finland. Then he ends up in Germany. And here he is with the Kaiser during German military maneuvers. The point is, the European nations, European powers and sovereigns, the monarchs, treat him like a world leader. And what they assume that Roosevelt was president and Roosevelt will be president. So they treat him in such a way that it's clear that they think that he's going to be president again. Right? He's going to go back, he's going to run for office, he's going to be president. Right? And so they accord him all of the recognitions of a world leader in that sense. When he's in Germany, King Edward VII dies. And Taft asks him to, of course, represent the United States at the funeral, and he does that. And he, you know, hobnobs all these people. He writes his son Archie. He says, if I see another king, I'll punch him in the face. Right? Tired of seeing kings. They actually loved every minute of it. Right? He loved also the way he was being treated, because they assumed he was going to be the policymaker in the future. So that's why they want to talk to him about policy. And so, I mean, they're very, very, very much insistent on that idea, and he's doing nothing to let them think otherwise. And, of course, while all this is taking place, that falling out with Taft is developing. Largely over conservationist policies, right? Taft rejects his conservationist policies. It's a big reason why Roosevelt and Taft have a falling out. And Roosevelt will challenge Taft, right, for the nomination, for the Republican nomination. The Bull Moose Party who comes out of this, in the primary elections that are direct, in the direct primaries, in the Republican primary, Roosevelt wins 75% of the delegates. But they're not all direct, right? And so the delegates that are at the convention actually go with Taft, which causes Roosevelt and his supporters to split, and they form the Progressive Party or the Bull Moose Party. And so you had a split, and that's essentially how Wilson would end up getting elected in 1912, right? And so then you shift to Wilson as policymaker, and Wilson is so different, right? I mean, as T.R. was essentially realist, Wilson is an idealist who really didn't want to deal with foreign policy issues, really wanted to concentrate on domestic policy. And it wrote very early in his presidency, wouldn't it be terrible if I had to focus on foreign policy? I have no background in it. He had all kinds of problems. I'll skip through a few slides here. In Mexico, right? In the Mexican Revolution, he has a very stop-and-go type of policy. He doesn't move to support these various factions, these various generals in Mexico who are vying for control of Mexico. It kind of shows a lack of savvy on his part. But, of course, the big issue he has to deal with is, of course, World War I, right? When Europe goes to war in 1914, Wilson declares the United States should be neutral in thought as well as action. By the way, Theodore Roosevelt, who was going to be Wilson's main critic in terms of foreign policy, wants to get involved. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt wants the United States into the war because he believed that if the United States was not in the war, the United States would not decide what the world looks like when things are through. We wouldn't have a place at the table. And so he's always interested in us getting involved in the conflict. Roosevelt hates Wilson so much because he's so jealous of Wilson because Wilson has power at this particular point. But Wilson says we're going to be neutral in thought as well as action. Nothing could be further from the truth. We're not really neutral at all. In fact, if you look at finances, the United States' American interest would loan to the Allies $11,656,932,900. During the First World War. In 1915-1916, American citizens would purchase $1.5 billion in Allied war bonds. The focus, the financial center of the world, moves from London to New York in these years because we're definitely siding with one side over the other. Again, there's so many things that would draw us toward Britain rather than Germany. Also, Germany's violation of Belgian neutrality in the very first month of the war, which violates a treaty that they are party to as Prussia, the Treaty of 1839 that preserves Belgian neutrality in perpetuity. You know, that treaty itself and that violation of it, and, of course, German atrocities in Belgium, all, of course, do not help the image of Germany in American public opinion. But two things really basically get us into the war. One is the U-boat issue, political cartoon. One is the U-boat issue, the German use of unrestricted submarine warfare. You got to remember, in World War I, you have so many different new weapons that really kind of break down the distinction between civilian and military personnel. Right? You really start to have bombing in the First World War. Very simple at first. Literally at first is drop it over the side. I mean, when they first start doing it, it's literally drop it over the side of the plane. But you have bombing, you have submarines that can attack merchant shipping and things of that nature. That distinction between military and civilian personnel is really in tatters with the First World War. And of course, the Lusitania is what we're kind of getting at, right? May 1915, the Lusitania is sunk by a German U-boat off the coast of Ireland. You have 1,198 killed, 128 of which are American citizens. The Germans had taken out ads in American newspapers warning American citizens not to be passengers on belligerent vessels, because the British often would use even passenger liners, you know, to move munitions. There were over 4,200,000 rifle cartridges on the Lusitania. I mean, the Lusitania took down 28 minutes. Right, 28 minutes. I mean, its sister ship, the Titanic, was struck by an iceberg, 1912, right? It took how long to go down? Two and a half hours. If you watched the movie, you didn't think the thing was ever going to go down, right? I've never understood that, right? I've also never understood why the bad guy didn't just smack little Leonardo around and throw him overboard. You know, leave my woman alone. I've never gotten that, but. This thing goes in 28 minutes. I mean, why you have such a loss of life on the Titanic is lack of lifeboats. One of the results of that was, of course, legislation in Britain and in the United States requiring numbers of lifeboats. Lusitania has all kinds of lifeboats. You have no time. And that tends to kind of, you know, lend credence to the idea that all the munitions on there had something to do with the huge gaping hole inside the ship, right? The British make good use of the Lusitania in terms of propaganda. The bodies they recover from the water, especially the women and the children, the babies, they take pictures and use it for propaganda purposes. Back in the United States, you had over 100, you know, American citizens killed. People who are interested in intervention, like Theodore Roosevelt, are calling for war, right? Roosevelt says it's just murder. And in 1916, he writes a book called Fear God and Take Your Own Part, which is part Sunday school lesson, part military preparedness, right? Which there was a volume of that actually in Concord's main library. And he becomes intensely critical of Wilson because Wilson is not wanting to get involved. And in fact, Roosevelt will say of Wilson, and I quote, "The man must be a vegetarian, lacking in the necessary red corpuscles that come from eating meat," unquote, which is T.R.'s way of saying Woodrow Wilson's yellow, he's a coward. Wilson very reluctant to get involved. Your political cartoon with the Kaiser Germany did pay reparation to the United States for the loss of lives. It's kind of obviously an anti-German cartoon. Is, you know, here's a few coins for your Americans. Right? The vulture representing death. What really gets us in though is not the U-boat, it's not the Lusitania. In fact, we stay out of the war, and Wilson, when he runs for re-election in 1916, runs basically on the idea that he kept us out of war. His Republican opponent is also not exactly an interventionist, Charles Evans Hughes. Carson had a slide had Charles Evans Hughes on it. Charles Evans Hughes will later be, of course, Supreme Court Justice. Roosevelt, who's kind of on the outside looking in since he had bolted the party in 1912, supports Hughes, even though privately he refers to him as the bearded lady. He really, really is jealous because he's not the guy in there. Right? The great irony is, of course, Roosevelt's healthy shot because he goes to the Amazon and charts the River of Doubt and contracts malaria, and his health is absolutely done. He dies in 1919. He probably would have been the guy in 1920. He was the hands-on favorite in 1920. But in 1916, it's just not possible for him to be the man. However, in 1917, the Zimmerman telegram actually draws us into war. And there's a great book by Barbara Tuchman on the Zimmerman telegram. Barbara Tuchman's worth reading anyway. Guns of August, right. Guns of August is about the first year, the first month, rather, of the First World War. She also wrote a book called The Proud Tower, which is about the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th. century about the coming of the war and all the prominent figures. Great narrative historian. Wonderful, wonderful writer. The Zimmerman telegram is an attempt on the part of Germany to get Mexico to declare war on the United States. And the idea is that Germany promises that if Mexico intervenes, that they will make sure Mexico gets back everything they lost in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Right? Just a promise they really couldn't keep, right? And the problem, though, with this is that it's intercepted. The British intercepted it and more than willing to let us read it. Right? And after that, even Wilson can't stay out. Because in April 1917, Wilson asks for a declaration of war. Actually goes to Congress and asks personally for that declaration of war. Wilson does something, you know, T.R. talked about the bully pulpit. But Wilson really does T.R. one better. Wilson reinstitutes direct relations with Congress. The annual address, or the State of the Union address. You realize that from Thomas Jefferson to William Howard Taft, it was not delivered in person. It was written and a clerk reads it before Congress to a largely an empty group, right? He's waiting to read the printed out version later, right? Wilson actually goes and makes an event out of it and makes a speech directly to Congress. When he asked for a declaration of war in April 1917, he goes directly and speaks to Congress. Jefferson had stopped that process for a couple reasons. One, Jefferson did not like public speaking. He was not comfortable with it. Two, Jefferson thought it was too British. I mean, you know, like the king, when the king opens Parliament, he thought it was too British. Wilson admires the British system. Wilson's here as Gladstone in many ways. And so Wilson goes and delivers the address in person and articulates, you know, here in 1917, 1918, why the United States wants to get involved in the war. You see it in the 14 points. Professor Surrey mentioned that. The idea that we have to have some purpose other than just victory. This has to be a war to end war, right? And the most important of the 14 points, I mean, the point number one, is no more secret diplomacy. You know, no more doing things like Bismarck and like Roosevelt did then, right? But the most important is the 14th point, right? In essence, you know, we need a League of Nations, and we need collective security in which everybody is obligated to preserve the territorial integrity and political independence of everyone else. So in other words, Wilson saw international relations as a matter of law, not as a matter of interest. I mean, from Roosevelt's point of view, he dies in January 1919. From Roosevelt's point of view, Wilson is living in fairyland, right? Roosevelt calls Wilson's diplomacy milk and water diplomacy. Bismarck had blood and iron, right? Roosevelt says that Wilson has milk and water, right? But Roosevelt, you know, Wilson sees it as a matter of international relations and will give way on the idea of a harsher treaty toward Germany, the Treaty of Versailles, in order to gain a League of Nations, because he believed the League of Nations would straighten out all of the ills of the agreement, right? And I think that very often, you know, when we think about the Treaty of Versailles, I've had a few slides here since I've run out of time. When we think about the Treaty of Versailles, we often kind of see it as a blueprint for World War II, and there's quite a bit to that. We think of it as being too harsh. My take on it is, in one hand, it's too harsh. It's too harsh to ever reconcile Germany. Any German government that places their name on it, you know, are always going to have to live with the fact that they did. It ruins them politically. It's too harsh to reconcile Germany, but in some ways it's too weak. In some ways it's too lenient. And look at the maps. I mean, look at Germany in 1914. It's 1914, that's 1920. In 1914, Germany has strong centralized neighbors. In 1920, Germany has these new upstart republics have been created by, of course, the Paris Peace Conference. Germany geopolitically is stronger in 1920 than they had been in 1914. They have all kinds of inducement to expansion if Germany ever militarily gets back on their feet. Right? Why is that the case? Largely because it's a compromise. It's a compromise between two different ways of looking at international relations. The only other point of reference that we could have would be the Congress of Vienna, you know, following the Napoleonic Wars. At the Congress of Vienna, they put everything back together again, but they all agreed on the principles. Everybody at the Congress of Vienna agrees that we should restore legitimate monarchs wherever possible. We should have a balance of power. If Prussia gets part of Poland, Russia should get part of Poland. Right? No one should get too much. They might disagree on particulars, but back at Vienna, after the Napoleonic Wars, they agree on the principles. And France is there! Right? Talleyrand represents, he'd been Napoleon's foreign minister, and he'd been the directories before that, and now then he was Louis XVIII's foreign minister. He's there representing France. France has a place at the table. France's right to exist is never questioned at the Congress of Vienna. They all agree on what they're trying to do. In Paris, in 1918, 1919, they do not agree. You have conflict. What comes out of it is compromise between Wilson's idealism. I mean, Wilson comes in with all these ideal principles, right? And when Wilson shows up, you know, Clemenceau and Lloyd George want to take him to see the front lines, to see the destruction. And Wilson won't go. Right? Wilson refused. Wilson says, I want to be the only man there who doesn't see red. I want to be the only one there who doesn't think about revenge, right? You have a compromise between Wilson's idealism and the realism of people like Clemenceau, right? The French premier, who had seen France invaded by German forces twice in his lifetime, right? Who really would like to dismember Germany, right? If not, spread salt on the ground, right? As the Romans had done to Carthage after the Third Punic War. He wants a harsh, he wants to secure France's security. And so you have a compromise between those two ways of looking at international relations. And so it really didn't satisfy anyone. And it certainly didn't satisfy the United States because the League of Nations in its charter required that every participant would be committed to the territorial integrity and political independence of everyone else. And so that's what Henry Cabot Lodge does not like. Right. And so when it gets back to be ratified by the Senate, Wilson tries to take it to the people. He goes on a whistle-stop tour and suffers a stroke. He suffers a very severe stroke and is incapacitated. In fact, Mrs. Wilson and Wilson's doctor conspire to keep him behind closed doors and away from anybody for a while. Lodge, of course, takes the thing apart in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And Lodge, and I love Professor Surrey's of this, Lodge is not an isolationist. He's one of those war-loving, expansionists of 1898. What Lodge doesn't like is the idea that the League of Nations will obligate us anywhere in the world. Because that's exactly what the treaty says. That's exactly what the charter for the League of Nations says. And so I think that you do kind of see an interesting contrast in terms of foreign policy between Roosevelt and Wilson. Ironically, in terms of domestic policy, they're very similar. I mean, their rhetoric is often different. But they're both progressives. I think in some ways, T.R. is a little more progressive than Wilson in terms of domestic policy. Wilson, eventually agrees to the 19th Amendment, only does so as a war measure. They had opposed women's suffrage his entire life up until that particular point. But you see that the real contrast in the two when it comes to foreign affairs. And so, very often, I think what you can see is when you look at the foreign policy of everyone afterward, is you can think, is it more realist? Is it more idealist? Who's had more influence? I mean, which way of looking at it? Clearly, I haven't read Professor Surrey's book yet, but clearly he argues that the idealism is something that predates Wilson. That in essence, Wilson fits better into the general thrust of American foreign relations and Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt would be somewhat of an anomaly, a realist anomaly. Okay, I tell you what, you can ask questions, and each question will cost you 15 minutes.
No question.
All right. All right, I thank you for your attention. Appreciate it, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
are listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.